It's an honor to be able to give this lecture today on the reliability of the documents of the Old Testament. And I want to focus particularly on the history of the transmission of the Old Testament text. So, by way of introduction, the authors of the text of the Old Testament produced their work between the 15th and 4th centuries B.C. How can we know that the final form of the text, regarded as canonical by the 2nd century B.C., has been transmitted to us in a reliable and trustworthy manner? That's the question that I want to address. The final form of the Old Testament was there by the 2nd century B.C., and how can we know that this text has been transmitted to us in a reliable and trustworthy manner? The answer to this question can be provided in two ways. Number one, by describing all major witnesses to the text of the Old Testament which have survived, whether they are copies of the original text in Hebrew and Aramaic, or whether they are ancient translations or versions deriving from the Hebrew text. And secondly, by detailing the history of the transmission of the text of the Old Testament. So we're going to look, Roman numeral 2, as the history of the transmission of the Hebrew text. I want to begin by discussing how the Hebrew manuscripts that we have and the transmission of the text. And then if I have time, I will talk about the ancient translations into Greek and Latin and Syriac and Aramaic. So, capital A is the textual transmission prior to 300 B.C. Point number one, books in the ancient Near East. Before the invention of the printing press in 1450 A.D., all books were copied by hand. Producing books was painstaking and slow work. We can call books created in this way manuscripts, a term derived from two Latin words, manus, meaning hand, and scriptus, meaning written. So a manuscript is something that is handwritten. Only one biblical text of any sort has survived from before 300 B.C., and this is the silver scrolls from Chetef Hinnom, which is a cemetery not far from Jerusalem. These little silver plaques bear the text of Numbers 6, 24 to 26, and date from the 7th to the 6th century B.C. So this was a kind of amulet with the Aaronic blessing on it. Yivarekha Adonai v'yishmarekha, Ya'ir Adonai panau eleka v'chunekha, Yissa Adonai panau eleka v'yasem leka shalom. The Lord bless you and keep you, and so on. Although we have essentially no, you can see actually, we'll look at this for a second. This is blown up. They're actually very small. They're only about this big. And you can see the divine name in the old Hebrew letters, YHWH, which actually occurs three times in this text. So there's a verse out of the Bible from the 6th century B.C. Although we have essentially no manuscripts surviving from the earliest period, we do have a knowledge of bookmaking and also of certain features of the text at this time. The Old Testament was copied and transmitted as a collection of individual rolls or scrolls. Scrolls were made of leather or papyrus. A large scroll would be about 10 inches by 24 feet. That is the size of the great Isaiah scroll found at Qumran, and normally contained only one book of the Old Testament. It might require as many as 20 sheepskins, so this was an expensive thing. Only consonants were written in early Hebrew writing. So there's a picture of a scroll. I just want to skip over this. This is an illustration of a consonantal text. So this says, this is the background slide on the consonantal text. And it gives you an idea of, for those who don't know Hebrew, what early Hebrew writing was like. Some of these words are clear. It's very easy to identify the word background and consonantal and text. You can guess that the TH is the article. This, of course, THS could be this or these or those, but once you have a context, it's not hard to figure out that it could only be this, since it's a singular and not a plural. So it's actually not too difficult, and the right vowels that you should supply was passed down from father to son, from priest to priest, and from scribe to scribe, done very reliably. Books like 1 and 2 Samuel, 1 and 2 Kings, 1 and 2 Chronicles were originally considered one book and were written on a single scroll. Later, when the Old Testament was translated into Greek, these books could no longer be contained in one scroll because Greek writing, like English, represents vowels as well as the consonants. So it's not just because it was translated from Hebrew into Greek, it's because Greek writing has the vowels. That increases the amount of space by 50%. So if you take the vowels out, you can cut down the amount of space by 50%. And now books like Samuel had to be put onto two scrolls. And that's why we have a 1 and 2 Samuel and a 1 and 2 Kings and a 1 and 2 Chronicles. Number two, the transmission of the scriptures. Clues from different sources demonstrate that from the beginnings of the Old Testament to 300 BC, there were two tendencies at work in the transmitting of the text. Number one, a tendency to preserve the text, and number two, a tendency to update the text, that is, to make sure that the next generation could understand it. First of all, preserving the text. And there are four points here. First of all, the ancient Near Eastern concept of a canonical text. The concept of a fixed official document was well established in ancient Near Eastern thinking before the beginning of the Bible. One example comes from ancient Near Eastern law codes, the Code of Hammurabi, which by any scholar's reckoning is at least 200 years prior to the time of Moses, contains commands not to add or take away from the law and brings down the curses of many gods upon the person who attempts in any way to alter the written form of this code. Ancient Near Eastern treaties were also written down and you could not add or take away from them. So this concept of a fixed official document was in the ancient Near East before the Bible was written. Secondly, ancient Near Eastern scribal practices and skills. Scribes in the ancient Near East were accurate and conservative in transmitting texts, much more so than scribes in the Greco-Roman period. In Egypt, for example, such documents as the Book of the Dead, the coffin texts, and the pyramid texts were carefully copied, even though they were never intended to be seen by human eyes after being placed in the pyramids. In the colophon of a text from 1400 BC, one scribe boasted, the book, quote, is completed from its beginning to its end, having been copied, revised, compared, and verified sign by sign, end quote. The ancient Israelites were not illiterate and had properly trained scribes, just as in Egypt and Mesopotamia. It is also clear now from the Dead Sea Scrolls, as well as from ancient inscriptions, that Hebrew scribes employed word dividers, unlike early scribes of the Greek New Testament. Nevertheless, some errors of wrong division of words did occur, probably due to the crowding of words in some copies. So this is an example of what can happen with improper word division. This could be read as God is nowhere or God is now here. And it's very, very important difference. This shows how letters can be confused. In Genesis 10, verse 4, we have the Dodanim, and in 1 Chronicles 1, 7, they're called the Rodanim. It's the difference between a D and an R, and you can see that it's very easy to confuse these two letters. If just ask any beginning student of Hebrew. So, ancient Near Eastern scribal practices and skills. The history of Israel. Biblical and post-biblical narratives indicate the preservation of the text despite difficult times. For example, one may recall the story of the restoration of the temple and the true worship in the time of Josiah in 2 Kings 22 and how they found the scroll and it was preserved. Number four, the excellent state of the surviving text. The excellent state of the surviving text also testifies to the careful copying of the text at this time. Textual criticism, by definition, focuses on the differences between the manuscripts. This often obscures from view the high degree of agreement found in our textual witnesses. So all of our witnesses, and there are thousands of manuscripts, they agree on at least 90% of the text. So textual critics are only arguing about a small percentage of the text. So this has to do with preserving the text. The other tendency at this time was to modernize or to update the text. And I give three illustrations. Number one, updating the script. Various bits of evidence, such as ancient inscriptions, indicate that the Old Testament was probably written in the Canaanite or Paleo-Hebrew script. Use of this archaic script in biblical texts, however, was replaced by the Aramaic script somewhere toward the end of the period in question, 300 BC. The Aramaic script is also called the square script because the letters have a square shape, or sometimes the Assyrian script because of its origin. And you can see what I've done here is I've taken verses out of Psalm 139 and I've written them in the old Hebrew script, and then at the bottom you can see the square script that we are using today. So at some point, a scribe said, well, if my children are going to read this text, I'm going to have to change from the old script to the new script for them to be able to read this text. Secondly, updating in spelling. At first, Hebrew writing was restricted to consonants. The Hebrew alphabet, as such, has no system for vowels, and no vowels were represented in any way in their system of writing. Beginning in the 9th century BC, scribes began to employ a few set consonants to mark long vowels at the ends of words, and in the 8th century to mark long vowels in the middle of words as well. This is the Siloam Tunnel inscription, and there's a copy of this in our museum here at Southern Seminary. It's a little bit hard to read in this state, but this shows you what is on this text. It's the inscription in the tunnel that King Hezekiah's engineers made to make sure that when the Assyrians came and surrounded them with a siege, they didn't have to send a water boy out to get water, because the spring that supplies the city of Jerusalem is outside the city wall. It's kind of hard to pay water boys when the Assyrian army is there. So they made a tunnel and brought the spring inside the wall. And this is a very interesting inscription that talks about this. You can see that it has the old Hebrew script, the Paleo-Hebrew script, and that is a good indication of what the Bible was probably written at this time. this dot here, these dots are word dividers. So that shows you that it would have been very easy to make sure that you had the right division in the words. This line here says, Hamayim min hamotza al habaraka bamthayim ba'elef, and so on. It's the waters that come from the source to the pool is a 1,200 cubits. Ama, that's the word for cubits. So this is the inscription that talks about that. Gives us an illustration of what things were like. Updating in grammar. There was a major revision of the grammar of the Hebrew language in approximately 1350 BC. Final short vowels were lost. The case system was lost. And there was a change in pronunciation. The long A's were pronounced like O's. Similar to the same kinds of changes that happened in the English language around the 13th or 14th century AD, where the case system was lost and a shift from long A to long O. So instead of saying snaw, we say snow. If you look at the poems of Robbie Burns, you see that you have the original spelling there. Textual transmission from 300 BC to 135 AD. So in the first period, we have two tendencies, a tendency to preserve the text, to copy it as is, and also a tendency to update the text, that is to make sure that the next generation can understand the writing and the grammar and so on. These changes, of course, are not significant. It doesn't matter whether you spell night, N-I-G-H-T, or N-I-T-E. It's still the same word. All right, the textual transmission from 300 B.C. to 135 A.D. The evidence for the text. Prior to the discovery of the Dead Sea Scrolls, we had almost no manuscripts from this time, but we did have evidence of an indirect nature. For example, the Old Testament was translated from Hebrew into Greek between the 3rd century B.C. and the 1st century B.C. Although the oldest manuscripts of the Septuagint, as we call this translation, are from a later time, we can learn from them something of the character of the Hebrew text from which they are translated. Between 1947 and 1956, however, a large number of manuscripts were discovered from an area of the Judean desert just 15 kilometers south of Jericho, which gives us firsthand knowledge of what the Hebrew text was like at this time. The manuscripts were discovered in caves nearby Qumran, the ruins of a Jewish community or sect who lived by the Dead Sea. There were fragments of about 900 books or manuscripts. Approximately 200 of these are biblical manuscripts. These manuscripts date from the 2nd century B.C. to the 1st century A.D. Actually, this shows you where most of the manuscripts were found at Qumran, but there were also manuscripts found at the Wadi Murabaat, the Nahal Hever, the Nahal Se'elim. These are ravines. And then also at Masada. My pen is giving out here at the bottom, Masada. And also there are some found up in the Wadi at Daliya. This chart shows the number of the copies of manuscripts at Qumran, book by book. So, for example, there are 16 or 17 fragments. These are not complete manuscripts. Fragments of Genesis in the square script and three in the old Hebrew script. And so this goes down. This just gives you a rough idea of how many manuscripts. You can see that most of the manuscripts are of the Pentateuch, Isaiah, and the Psalms. And there are manuscripts from every book found except the book of Esther. This shows you the number of copies at Qumran by cave. So one fragment of Genesis in cave 1, 12 in cave 4, and 3 in cave 11. Gives you a little idea of cave 4 is the one that has the most copies, but there are also very small fragments, and many of them with hardly more than a word or two. I guess we can look at these slides while we're here. This one is the called. It's the 11. It's the Paleo Hebrew scroll of Leviticus from Qumran Cave 11. And you can see that the top of the scroll has deteriorated and the bottom of the scroll has deteriorated. Only the middle has survived. Much like something that our books, if they were damaged, you'd lose the front chapter and the back chapter, and only the middle would be surviving. And you can see where you can see over here where two pieces of sheepskin have been sewn together, and the text is on these columns. This is a high contrast photo of the same thing. This is a close up of one of the fragments. And this says, Ha'aretz walo taki ha'aretz asher lifneikem. It's very interesting. There are no vowels here, but it's not that difficult to read. And you can see the dots. You can see the dots between the words. So this text has word dividers. This is an Leviticus 18, verse 27. It's the passage that says, if you follow the practices of the Canaanites, then the land will vomit you out. But if you follow the Torah, then the land will not vomit you out. So walo taki, the land will not vomit. Those are the words that have been preserved here. Fragments of approximately 12 biblical texts written in the Paleo-Hebrew script were also found at Qumran, mostly Torah manuscripts. So it's interesting that most of the manuscripts that still have the old Hebrew script are Pentateuch or Torah manuscripts. The non-biblical manuscripts found at Qumran comprise commentaries and literature pertaining to the Jewish sect who lived there. The great Isaiah scroll. This is an example of the square script. This is the style of script we call the Herodian script. And this is Isaiah 40. Kol Omer Kara Wa Omra Ma Ekra. The voice says, cry. And I said, what shall I cry? All flesh is grass, and all its charm is like the glory of the field. The flower fades and so on, but the word of our God stands forever. Now, I thought we'd look at this just for a moment because you can see that, if I can get this thing to work right, there's a problem right here. What happened is, I'm going to go ahead a couple of slides here. This is a close-up. This is a close-up looking at this particular problem right here. If you look at Isaiah 40 in the Hebrew, you can see, do we have this in English? Ah, we do. You can see that this line here and this line here are actually identical. The grass withers, the flower fades. When the breath of the Lord blows upon it, surely the people are grass. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of our God stands forever. What happened when he was copying the text is he looked up at his manuscript, and he copied this line. And he looked down, and he copied that line into his text. When he looked up again, instead of looking up here and copying this part, he looked up here because it's the same, and started copying here, which means he missed all this text in here. This kind of mistake is called a parablepsis, and all biblical manuscripts have this mistake. It's very easy for your eye to skip from two words that have the same beginning or two words that have the same ending. But the interesting thing is that he caught it. All right? So he put dots here to show that these letters are to be deleted. He didn't have any white out. And then the part that you're supposed to add, he put in here and he wrote down the margin. You can So we laugh, but the point of it is the Word of God was preserved, you see. He checked his work and corrected the mistake. So this should give you some confidence. The character of the text. Different types of text are represented by these manuscripts. Some of the texts at Qumran appear to be intended for popular use, others for scholarly use or official use within the temple. Broadly speaking, then, we can classify the manuscripts into two groups, popular and standard texts. I don't think it's any different from going into a Christian bookstore where you have texts for scholars, and then you have the Precious Moments Bible, you know. So there are scholarly texts, and there are texts for popular use, where certain liberties are taken to make sure that people appreciate and understand the text. Copyists of popular texts freely made many changes and corrections to the text, and used idiosyncratic forms and spellings. Some differences in popular texts are due to the ideologies and interpretations of the communities who use them. By contrast, standard texts were copied very conservatively. Approximately 35% of the biblical manuscripts represent the forerunner of our present Masoretic Hebrew text. Another 20% represent the same text but follow a different spelling tradition. Another 10% represent the kind of Hebrew text that lies behind the Septuagint in the places where it differs. And some of the texts represent the kind of tradition that we have in the Samaritan Pentateuch, and about 35% don't seem to fall into any category. But on the whole, the biblical text represented by the Dead Sea Scrolls is much the same text that we have 1,000 years later in our Masoretic manuscripts. Number three, the establishment of an authoritative text. I'm going to give you the standard view and then my own view. The standard view is that by about 50 AD, Jewish leaders had chosen a particular text as the authoritative text. The text that they chose was extremely ancient and of the highest quality. The evidence for this is twofold. We have biblical scrolls from Masada, and these are easy to date because Masada was destroyed in the Jewish revolt 66 to 73 AD. And the other manuscripts come from the Bar Kokhba rebellion, some guy that thought he was the Messiah. There were quite a few in the first century. There was only one real one, but quite a number that thought they were the Messiah. And this is the Bar Kokhba rebellion, which happened from 130 to 135. And in the Nahal Hever, Nahal Se'alim, and the Wadi Mirabaat, these are gullies or ravines in the Judean desert where these manuscripts were found. These manuscripts are all very much like our Masoretic text from 1,000 years later. We also have Jewish revisions of the Septuagint. The Greek translation was adopted by the Christian church, and the Jewish people didn't like the Christians trying to prove that Jesus was the Messiah. So out of this translation, so they said it was corrupt, and they tried to revise it and make the translation closer to the Hebrew text. We have the Minor Prophet Scroll from 50 BC to 50 AD, and we have the versions of Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion, and these are revisions of the Septuagint, and they're all identical to our Masoretic text. There are two interpretations of this material. One interpretation is that before the time of Jesus, the text was fluid, and there were many varieties of the text. And that after the time of Jesus, the Jewish leaders standardized the text and decided on one particular text. My view is that before the time of Jesus, there were two tendencies, a tendency to preserve the text and a tendency to revise the text. And after the fall of Jerusalem, there was only one tendency, the tendency to preserve the text, that is, to copy it as is. There was no longer any updating of the text in any way, shape, or format. And this makes it look like the text was standardized at this time. But in actual fact, what we have is something that went back a long ways before that. This is the classification of the of the Dead Sea Scrolls that you find in the book by Emmanuel Tov, who is one of the great textual scholars of our time. He classifies the Dead Sea Scrolls. He says 20% of them represent the Qumran practice, 35% are the proto-Masoretic text, the text behind our Masoretic text, 5% pre-Samaritan, 5% Septuagint, this should be 35% are non-aligned. That's a mistake on my PowerPoint thing. So if you look at this, it makes it look like there's a great variation in the text at this time, but this evidence can be interpreted differently. First of all, we see that 35% of the manuscripts actually are the same tradition that we find in the Masoretic text. 20% are in Qumran practice. All that this means is that they had a different approach to spelling and grammar, but it's really the same text. So it doesn't matter whether, as I say, you spell the word night, N-I-T-E, or N-I-G-H-T, it's still the same word. You really still have the same text. So we can add this together to get 55%. 5% represents the Samaritan tradition, which I'll talk about in a moment. 5% is close to the Septuagint, where it differs from the Hebrew text. But in the majority of the books, it has the same kind of Hebrew text that we find in our later Masoretic text. 35% of the manuscripts are non-aligned. This is really a false statistic, because you can't, in textual criticism, you cannot count variants. You have to weigh them. Every manuscript has what the Germans call Besonderlesarten, so peculiar readings. And this happens in every manuscript, and it doesn't really prove that there's a great variation in the text. You have to weigh each variation and assess it as to whether it's an important variation or a stupid mistake of some sort. And so just counting variants doesn't really get you anywhere. And someone like Emmanuel Tov should know this. So the evidence, I think what the evidence shows is that around the time of Jesus, there were two traditions. There was a group of scrolls that represent very careful and conservative copying, probably used within the temple, and then a group of scrolls that represent a popular text, probably used outside the temple, in circles outside the temple. And doesn't the fact this variation in the text doesn't mean anything more than the variation we find in a Christian bookstore today. Just because we find different kinds of Bibles in our Christian bookstore, you know, paraphrases and various kinds of translations, doesn't mean that somehow the text is in doubt. All right. The textual transmission from 135 to 1000 AD, very quickly. From 135 to 500 AD, features of the text at this time include division into verses, but not the numbering of the verses. The chapter divisions are very late. They are of Christian origin, introduced into Hebrew manuscripts in 1330 from Vulgate manuscripts, and were established by Archbishop Stephen Langton of Canterbury, England, in the early 13th century. So you can disregard the chapter divisions. They weren't introduced until the 13th century. Division into paragraphs. In the Babylonian tradition, they read the Torah once every year, and in the Palestinian tradition, they read the Torah once every 3 years. So they divided it into paragraphs to show how much could be read on each Sabbath. paratextual features to mark special aspects of the transmission of the text. For example, in Judges chapter 18, this tribe had a false priest, and this priest happened to be the grandson of Moses. But that was very embarrassing, so they put a little N, a raised N, in the middle of the word Moses and said he wasn't really the grandson of Moses, he was the grandson of Manasseh, the most wicked king in Israel. So certain little changes in the text that represent rabbinic interpretation were added at this time. Changes to avoid indelicate expressions, like the name Ishbosheth in 1 Chronicles 8:33 is a man called Ishbaal in 2 Samuel 2:8. Ishbaal means man of Baal, which is not a cool name for someone who's supposed to be believing in Yahweh. So the writer of Chronicles changed it to Ishbosheth, man of shame. So using the word shame instead of writing the word for the idolatrous word Baal or Baal. So these kinds of changes came into the text at this time. They just represent the rabbinic attitudes towards the text. From 500, secondly, from 500 to 1,000, this is the period of the Masoretes, Jewish scholars who did two things. They preserved the consonantal text, and secondly, they put the vowels and the accents in. Important evidence for this period comes from the Cairo Geniza manuscripts. When an American flag wears out, you don't put it in the garbage. There's a proper procedure for getting rid of an American flag. And when a Hebrew scroll wears out, you don't put it in the garbage. You put it in a room at the back of the synagogue called the Geniza. They just store them there and leave them there. And in the 1800s, they broke into the Geniza in the old synagogue in Cairo and found all these old manuscripts there, and they show us the history of the text, the early history at this time, and these are examples of early manuscripts. The Masorah means transmission or tradition and is based on the earlier work of the Soferim, who counted the letters and words of the Old Testament. So they actually counted all the letters and words and made marginal notes to show what was going on. So when you finished copying a book, you had to copy all the letters, and if the number came up wrong, then you knew there was a mistake. Shows how carefully the text was copied. Secondly, the vocalization and accents. The Masoretes devised a system of signs to represent the vowels and committed the reading tradition handed down before that time orally to writing. At the beginning, only a few vowels were shown. Later, all the vowels were shown under the influence of Syriac and Arabic literature. Secondly, they also developed a set of diacritical marks to show the accentuation of the text, how it was chanted in the synagogue. The history of the Jewish people at this time correlates with different groups of Masoretes. First, a large-scale emigration of scholars to Babylon occurred in the 2nd century AD as the Romans and Christians pushed them out. Later, the conquest of Palestine by Islam in 638 AD made possible a return to Palestine of Jewish scholars and a revival of textual work in Galilee. As a result, there are different systems of vocalization. There's the Tiberian system, the Palestinian system, and the Babylonian system. This is just a quick... These are manuscripts from the 3rd century to the 7th century. They're all very much like our later text. These are the most important manuscripts before 1100. There aren't very many, but... we have photographic facsimiles of the Aleppo Codex and the Leningrad Codex in our library. This is an example of the Aleppo Codex. I think this is the Song of Moses in Deuteronomy 30. Two 2 or either Judges 5. You here. I have a better picture, I think, of this is a British Museum Oriental 4445. Let's have a look at this for a moment. This is a typical Masoretic manuscript, and it's dated to about 850 A.D. So this manuscript has the Torah. You can see that the consonants are written in three columns. These are the consonants. These little dots underneath the letters, in the letters, and on top of the letters represent the vowels and show how you are to pronounce these the words. And in the margin, these letters here, this is what we call the Masorah, and these are notes. So, for example, down here, I think this is a Gimel. This particular expression here, the Gimel with the dot over the top, means that this expression occurs three times. So if you have a scribe and he thinks that there's a funny spelling here and he wants to change it, this little note says, keep a you hands off, just copy it like you see it, because this is the way it's spelled here, and this spelling is found three times in the Hebrew Bible. So this system of notes made sure that it was accurately transmitted in this 1,000-year period with hardly any variation whatsoever. This one up here, let's see if I can get this thing to work. I need a new one of these, I guess. This is a lamed with a dot on top. So it means that this expression here only occurs once in the Hebrew Bible. And don't worry if you think it's spelled funny. Just copy it like you see it. Manuscripts after 1100. Let's see. Manuscripts after 1100, there are more than 6,000 manuscripts from the Middle Ages. They have been analyzed by Kennicott and De Rossi. Actually, our own Dr. Allison wrote an article on this Italian scholar who was a conservative scholar and did a lot of work on the text. Generally, they are classified according to geographical provenance, Italy, Germany, France, or Spain. Just a quick comment on early printed Hebrew Bibles. Printed Hebrew Bibles began to appear towards the end of the 15th century. The earliest examples include the Psalms, 1477 in Bologna, the Prophets, 1485 to 86 in Sonsino, the Writings, 1486 to 87 in Naples, and the Pentateuch, 1491 in Lisbon. The Jewish people are very conservative about holding on to scrolls, and they didn't want to use the new technology, and so the Pentateuch was the last one to be printed. The first complete Hebrew Bibles that were printed were published in Sonsino, 1488, Naples, 1491-93, and Brescia, 1494, so in Italy. By the 16th century, printed editions replaced manuscripts in most of Europe. The so-called rabbinic Bibles were developed at the beginning of the 16th century. The most significant of these is the second rabbinic Bible. See, I think I might, I don't know, I don't think I have one of those. The second rabbinic Bible, which was edited by Jacob ben Chaim and printed by Daniel Bomberg in Venice, 1524-1525. We have a replica of it in our library. Based on manuscripts from the 12th century, it offered a Hebrew text with accents and vowels, marginal notes, the Masorah, the Aramaic Targums, and the commentaries of Rashi, Ibn Ezra, and David Kimke. So, the early Jewish version of the study Bible. And then, modern editions, we have the Biblia Hebraica, the third edition from 1929 to 1937, and the Biblia Hebraica Stuttgartensia from 1967 to 77, and now the new edition is the Biblia Hebraica Quinta. We only have three fascicles published in that. And all of these are based on the manuscript, the Codex Leningradensis B19A, which is in St. Petersburg. And this is the reason for this. This manuscript dates to 1008 A.D., and it's the oldest complete manuscript of the Hebrew Bible, and that's why it's used as the basis for our modern print and texts. I'm going to talk about the ancient versions. I have only 13 minutes here, so this will be quick. First of all, the Samaritan Pentateuch, its history and character. First of all, its history. We can describe the origin and history of the Samaritan Pentateuch by noting, number one, Jewish attitudes towards Samaritans, and number two, Samaritan attitudes towards Jews. Jewish attitudes towards Samaritans were consistently marked from the start by refusing close relations from the exile onward. On the other side, Samaritan attitudes toward Jews were marked by periods of copying Jewish ways and periods of separating from Jews until 128 BC, when the final breach came between Jews and Samaritans. John Hyrcanus, Jewish governor and high priest, attacked and destroyed both Shechem and the Samaritan sanctuary, and that did it. So they were enemies from that time on. From this time, their biblical text must have been copied in isolation from the Jews. The Samaritans recognize only the Pentateuch. The Samaritan Pentateuch was later translated into Aramaic and Arabic. And you can see here that they have, here's the Samaritan Pentateuch. They did not change to the square script. They kept using the old Hebrew script. All right? So they're sort of like they're kind of like the Amish, you know, preserving the older culture. This is the Hebrew, this is the Aramaic in the same script, and this is Arabic written in Hebrew script. So it's kind of a Muslim view of inspiration, where you just keep it in Arabic and you don't translate it. Now, the interesting thing about the Samaritan Pentateuch is that it represents an updated text. So a text that is grammatically and lexically and geographically updated. And this text must go back at least to the 2nd century BC. So if we compare this text with our Masoretic text, and this text represents a text that's updated in relation to the Masoretic text, then it actually points to the antiquity of the Masoretic text, because it, by comparison, is not updated in these ways. So even though our manuscripts, our oldest manuscripts of the Masoretic text are from 1000 AD, the Samaritan Pentateuch is a witness to the antiquity of the Masoretic text. The Septuagint, a document known as the Letter of Aristeus, purports to give the story of the origin of the Greek translation of the Hebrew Old Testament. This document is a piece of propaganda written around 150 to 100 BC to authenticate the Greek version of the Pentateuch in the face of criticisms circulating at that time, criticisms to the effect that the Greek translation did not accurately reflect the current Hebrew text in Palestine. So it was a debate that went like this. The Jews in Palestine told the Jews in Egypt that if they really wanted to read the Bible, they had to read it in Hebrew. And they said, well, the Greek translation is inspired. So if it's good enough for Paul, it's good enough for us. So it's if we think that the debates that are going on today are anything new, the same kind of debates went on 2,000 years ago about what version and translation you should be using. The name Septuagint comes from Septuaginta, the Latin word for 70. According to the legend, there were 72 translators. And this translation was done in the time of Ptolemy II Philadelphus, 285 to 240 BC in Alexandria, Egypt, likely for the benefit of the Alexandrian Jews. Probably there were just 5 translators, one for each book of the Torah. The character. The books vary in the quality of translation. Some are fairly literal. Others are quite free in their rendering. The translator of the book of Job abbreviated many of the long, windy speeches so that the book is about 1/6 shorter in Greek. So he was afraid that his Hellenistic audience wouldn't make it through some of these speeches, and he abbreviated them. Other books have additions to them, such as Esther and Daniel. The book of Daniel was considered so deficient by the Christian church that it was rejected, and another translation, made by Theodotion, was used instead. The Greek Jeremiah differs somewhat from the Hebrew text. The differences between the Septuagint and the Masoretic text are due to a number of reasons. In some cases, the translators were using a Hebrew text which differs from our later Masoretic text. And in other cases, the differences are due to a different way of reading the text or a different way of understanding the grammar and words. The character of the Greek and the vocabulary used indicate that the Pentateuch was translated in Egypt by Jews living there. The oldest complete manuscripts of the entire Bible have additional books. Some of these are translations of Hebrew originals, and some were originally written in Greek. These books represent Jewish literature written between 300 BC and 100 AD and are known as the Apocrypha. They were not considered to be inspired by either the Jews or Christians, but were popular among both groups. So it's just like Christians today who have other books on their shelf that they like very much besides the Bible. Could be Wayne Grudem's Systematic Theology, could be something else, but it's right up there on their shelf with the Bible. This doesn't prove that they considered these books inspired. Recensions of the Septuagint. The Septuagint soon became popular among the Jews of the diaspora, for whom Greek was the familiar spoken language. When the Christian church began to spread beyond the Jewish borders, it adopted the Septuagint as its Bible. By the end of the first century AD, Jews were reacting against the use of the Septuagint, partly because it did not reflect current rabbinic teaching, and partly because the Christian apologetics was based on faulty renderings. Therefore, the Jews produced a number of revisions of the Septuagint to make it conform to the Hebrew text more closely, and those are the versions of Theodotion, Aquila, and Symmachus. I don't have those here. This is Codex Sinaiticus. It's from Jeremiah chapter 9. You can see that it's written in capital letters, and there are no word dividers, so it's a little harder to read here, if I can get this thing to work. It's Tas Tribus Tes Eremu, the paths of the desert. All right, so you can read that text. The translations of the Septuagint. The Septuagint was translated into Latin, into Syriac, into Coptic, into Gothic, Armenian, Old Slavic, Ethiopic, Arabic, and Old Georgian. So most of the ancient versions of the Bible were not made directly from the Hebrew text. They were made on the basis of the Septuagint, much like Wycliffe Bible translators in the last 50 years have often used modern translations as the basis of their work rather than translating from Greek and Hebrew. The Targums, the Aramaic Targums. The word Targum means translation. And it was customary in Talmudic times to translate biblical readings in synagogues simultaneously from Hebrew into Aramaic. Tradition traced the institution of this practice back to Ezra's reading of the law in Nehemiah chapter 8. The main reason, however, for the origin of the Targums must have been the fact that increasingly, in the post-exilic period, Aramaic replaced Hebrew as the vernacular of the Jews in Palestine. Though aimed primarily at a popular audience, the Targums are the work of scholars with a deep knowledge of Hebrew, Aramaic, and Bible exegesis. Eitan Levine notes, quote, "In fact, the earliest extant texts are all essentially literal translations of the Hebrew Bible and appear to be literary in origin, since Targum was part of the curriculum of the Palestinian schools, placed between the Hebrew Bible and the Mishnah." It is almost certain, then, that the Targums originated in an academic or school setting, and at no stage can they be envisaged as spontaneous renderings of untutored translators, although they doubtless influenced the synagogue translations. And we have three Targums from Qumran. There are two main Targums of the Pentateuch, Onkelos and the Palestinian Targums, which I've listed there. There are two Targums of the Prophets and several Targums of the Writings. Okay, this brings us to the Peshitta. Well, maybe I should make a comment about the character of the Targums. The Targums usually reflect the Masoretic text. Deviations are based mainly on exegetical traditions, not on deviating texts. Professor Bruce Waalke characterizes the Targums as follows. They are embellished by Jewish interpretations and traditions. Secondly, they avoid anthropomorphisms. Thirdly, they explain figurative language. And fourthly, they modernize geographical names. So it basically reflects the same text that we have in the Masoretic text with these kinds of updating for a later audience. Let's see. The Latin translations. I think we can do this in 2 minutes. There are two Latin translations. There's the Old Latin, which originated in Italy and North Africa around 150 AD. It is based on the Septuagint and is not a direct translation from the Hebrew. Then we have the Latin Vulgate. The word Vulgate means common, and it was supposed to be the common Bible for the common man. This translation was made by Jerome between 390 and 406 and is based on our Masoretic text. So if you look at Jerome's Latin Vulgate, it's very, very close to the later Masoretic text, and therefore is a witness to the fact that the later Masoretic text is exactly the same kind of text that Jerome had at that time. All right, the Peshitta. This is our last one, and then the Peshitta. This is the Syriac translation. The Syriac is a later dialect of Aramaic used in Syria. And there are churches there that still use this today in a very few places. One of my friends, Jan Devard, he's a great Old Testament scholar. He visited Eastern Turkey and he said he saw a priest preaching out of a 9th century Peshitta manuscript. All right, the history. Peshitta means simple. It's the name given the translation of the Bible into Syriac, a dialect of Aramaic. The name Peshitta distinguished this translation from the Syro-Hexapla, which was a translation of Origen's Hexapla into Syriac by Paul of Tella. The Syro-Hexapla was a scholarly work, and the language was very unnatural. So this is the simple translation as opposed to the complicated one for scholars. This manuscript is from 464. So, De Metul Hana Avedli Elaha Kav Nefketh Men Mitraim. This is the passage from Exodus chapter 13, where in the Passover, if the son says to the father, what does all this mean? The father says that we do this because of what God did for me when I came out of Egypt. And this is a copy of the... this is a manuscript from 697. It's a Syro-Hexapla manuscript. I don't really have time to go into that. It's a complicated story in itself, but it's a Syriac translation of Origen's six-column Bible into Syriac. This is the translation of the fifth column, and these are notes showing readings from Aquila, Symmachus, and Theodotion in the margin. So let me try to the translation of the Syriac Peshitta varies from book to book. Some books are literal, some are paraphrases. Both the Septuagint and the Syriac translations reflect rabbinic interpretations and traditions in the translation similar to those in the Targums. Hence, the Septuagint and the Peshitta frequently agree. The Hebrew parent text of the Syriac translation is basically identical to the Masoretic text. It offers less variance than the Septuagint, but more variance than the Targums or Vulgates. In certain books, like Genesis, Joshua, the Prophets, and the Solomonic books, it shows clear cases of sporadic dependence on the Septuagint. So the Syriac translators were working from the Hebrew text, but when they couldn't figure something out, they looked at the Septuagint and copied what they did. So this is basically a history of the transmission of the text. You can see that I've tried to cover the history of the Hebrew manuscripts. You can see that these were very reliably copied over the years. And that in addition to that, we have ancient translations which were made at a time older than a lot of our Hebrew manuscripts. And they show that the later text that we have is the same one that they were using at an earlier period. So we have every reason to think that the text was copied very reliably between the 3rd century B.C. and 1500 A.D. When we, or 1000 A.D. And our Hebrew Bibles today are based on those manuscripts from 1000 A.D. So the text was copied very reliably, and the text that we have goes back to a very early and pristine source, as we can see from the evidence at Qumran. Thank you very kindly.